You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 13th, 2018, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, folks.
Kara is on assignment this week, so she can't make the show. Hey, have you guys seen that they're rebooting, of all things, In Search Of?
Oh man. Yes. Wait, Leonard Nimoy's dead. How are they going to do it?
He's not the only Spock in the universe, bro.
Yeah, so they got Zachary Quinto to host it, you know, the new Spock, so that they're keeping, you know, the Spock host theme, I guess.
Yep.
So the original one, I just looked it up. The original TV series was from 1977 to 1982. And, man, I know you guys remember. I totally remember watching this show.
Yeah. I mean, the first words of our book, you guys remember how the book opens?
Yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
The first words are, Spock lied to me. And it is about the betrayal of Leonard Nimoy hosting In Search Of, and basically telling us a pile of garbage, you know, every week on the show.
Yep.
And the journey that it took to figure out that, you know, that this figure, you know, Spock, basically this authority figure, was spewing utter nonsense that we ate it up when we were younger. You know, we thought it was, oh, this is all legit. This is just like the best science documentary on TV.
It was fun. I mean, I just loved watching that show. I really enjoyed it. The music was creepy. You know, there was always like, you know, there was such an amazing sense of wonder because everything seemed possible.
It was all wonder. Have you watched any episodes recently?
Terrible.
Does it hold up well over 50
years? No, it doesn't hold
years.
Up at all.
It's horrible. Horrible.
Well, I hope the new one will achieve better, results in a sense, science-wise. I did see the commercial or the first promotion for it. It's going to be on the History Channel, and it's coming up July 20th will be the first episode. From what I saw, I am very dubious as to what I think they are going to be presenting as real science. I think they're going to give us some kind of combination of actual science, but also a healthy dose of pseudoscience, just from what I saw in that 30-second commercial.
Which is worse.
It is worse.
When you mix it together, it's actually worse.
It is worse. I haven't seen it yet. There's not a lot to see or read about it yet on the internet. We've done a search for it, and there just isn't that much information. They're keeping it pretty tight for now. I hope we're wrong. I hope I'm wrong.
Well, here's the blurb. You're wrong. Here's the blurb.
Okay.
I mean, you're not wrong. You're not wrong. Here's the blurb from In Search Of, from the History Channel. Inspired by the iconic 1970s franchise, the series will examine unexplained phenomena from all over the world. UFOs and paranormal mysteries remain relevant as the Pentagon recently acknowledged a secret UFO program which investigated sightings of UFOs from 2007 to 2012. So that sounds like the show in a nutshell.
Yep. Okay. So
game over. Yep. That's it.
Yeah.
That's already been thoroughly debunked. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
They're appealing to the other crowd.
So they're saying that UFOs are explicable.
Well, I suppose in a way. Or that they exist, that they're real, that they are alien visitors, among other things. Yes, but they also talked about in the promotion I saw, they're going to be talking about nanotechnology and artificial intelligence. And this is where the danger comes in, because if they start to weave all this stuff together seamlessly, and it's a very slick looking show, very Star Trek-ish, if I might say, that's going to sell a lot of people to the idea that these things are legitimate science.
Yeah, it's like the Dr. Oz effect. Like, right? Mm-hmm. You mix the baloney with real stuff, and it's like you need some level of, you know, savviness to pick through that. You know, if you can't blanket trust them, then that's really pernicious.
Yeah, people are going to need a book to help them prepare for shows like this and other shows out there. Like
Evan, along those lines, I have a quote for you.
Okay.
In his 1995 book, The Demon-Haunted World, the great Carl Sagan prophesied a descent into superstition and ignorance. Well, that world has arrived. Fortunately, Steve Novella and his co-authors are here to help us navigate it with critical thinking and scientifically appropriate skepticism, along the way exposing the anti-science and pseudoscience so prevalent in our public discourse today. From confirmation bias to conspiracy theories, and race to Nessie, the face on Mars to flat eartherism. That was written by Michael Mann.
Awesome.
Mm.
The preprint of the book is ready, you know, and we've been sending it to people to review. And that was the first review that we got back from Michael Mann. It was very nice.
Very nice.
Yeah.
What a man.
So, obviously we're pimping our own book.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, which I think is going to be, it's actually ironic almost that, you know, we sort of, in a way, the book is a reaction, although 40 years, 50 years later, to In Search Of, and now they're rebooting it right as our book is coming out.
Hmm. Coincidence? I think not.
It's almost like it's on purpose.
Yes, by design.
I mean, there is something poetic about that, and to be honest, you know, I got excited when Evan told me this show was coming back on, because the first thing I thought was, well, that's why we're here.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. Like
if it comes out swinging in the wrong direction, which we're, you know, guessing, it seems like it will be. You know, we have, you know, educated ourselves and you know, a lot of the people in the skeptical community have educated themselves to the point where we all can collectively watch this show and use it as an exercise. And it's going to be our job at work the next day to tell people, nope, that was not accurate, yeah. And here's why.
Yeah, it's going to be offering us a ton of content.
This brings up an interesting thing, my dear friends.
Yeah.
Remember how there are people out there that say that skeptics should not talk about UFOs anymore or Bigfoot anymore or this and that anymore because it's old stuff. We don't need to keep it alive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by continuing to say it's BS. Remember mm-hmm. that, Steve?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
Well, here's the example about, you know, 40 years later, here's why skeptics should still be educated about Bigfoot and UFOs. Because, you know, all it takes is a TV show that's produced well to get people excited about these ideas again. And next thing you know, people are going to be believing in Bigfoot again in a way that they didn't a week ago because of the TV show.
The evidence shows that while millennials may be turning away from organized religion and things like that, they are turning towards these classic pseudosciences. Astrology sure. belief mm-hmm. is up.
I mean, when that happens.
So we're going to have to go through the whole thing all again with a new generation. And Zachary Quinto is going to be to this generation what Leonard Nimoy was to our generation, right?
Yeah.
Now we're the old guard skeptics who are going to be there to say, hey, nope, this is all BS.
Old.
But yeah, we can't hate to break it to you, Bob. And it's true that while obviously we branched out in a lot of directions with a lot of big, much bigger fish to fry that are have more impactful outcomes, we still are the experts in why these things are pseudoscience, you know, in the history of the UFO community and belief in Bigfoot and astrology and everything. And when a show like this is trying to introduce it to a new generation, we'll be like, nope, okay, here's this has already been done. We've been there, done that. Here's all the information. This is why astrology is BS. Here's what, you know, whatever, a dowsing or whatever it is that they're going to be sensationalizing.
Yeah, go to episode 51 and read this blog from 12 years ago and you're all set.
Mm-hmm. Right. I agree with you, Jay. I think the one thing the show did well was the wonder, you know, was to make things seem like so amazing. Although, not again, watching it back, not so much, but of course, I'm now looking at it through the eyes of a middle-aged skeptic, not a teenaged, you know, person who couldn't really differentiate yet between science and pseudoscience. But it's a shame that they're tapping into all of this wonder about the amazing things in the universe, but they're turning it towards pseudoscience, where mm-hmm. you could be tapping into that wonder and turning it towards real science, which is actually even more amazing
yeah.
than the pseudoscience.
That's the tragedy of the entire yeah. pseudoscience world.
I'm really disgusted. Is. Let's move on.
No, but listen, you know, it's easier to sell things that have bells and whistles that don't do anything, right? I mean, you know, pseudoscience, it is interesting. It's fun. It's exciting. It gives us hope and promise and all of those things. You know, it's Santa Claus.
It's just all fake. Yeah. It's just all fake. Yeah.
But it's fake. And that's the reason why when we talk about Carl Sagan and the demon haunted world and, you know, we go back to that generation, Carl Sagan, his communication style made me feel like I was learning about pseudoscience in the sense that it was that interesting. He mm-hmm. made it that much fun and that cool. And that's a once in a lifetime type of communicator. You know, I wish that we had 10 people that could communicate mm-hmm. like Carl. You know, I mean, his communication was so good that look at us, you know, 40 years later and we're like still in love with science and everything to do everything to do with it. It's just it's an obsession.
Yeah, I don't think anyone has quite captured his voice, you know.
Yep.
All right, well, let's move on with the show. Bob, you're going to start us off with a forgotten superhero of science.
Yeah, it's been a little while. So this week for Forgotten Superheroes of Science, I'm going to talk about Rachel Louise Carson, 1907 to 1964. She was a marine biologist, author, and conservationist who was critical in bringing environmental concerns to the public at large and even helping bring about the Environmental Protection Agency itself. So early in Carson's career, she was focused on aquatic biology at the U.S. Bureau of Fisheries. And then in the early 50s, she penned a trilogy of books about the sea, about the ocean. These books were The Sea Around Us, The Edge of the Sea, and Under the Sea Wind. Under the Sea. And then they were all bestsellers, all bestsellers. And in them, she explored all the varieties of life that were then known to inhabit the oceans. Really captivating stuff. Then the focus then began to shift for Carson to conservation. Conservation itself, which was exemplified in her 1962 book, Silent Spring. Now, it's this book that made these vast swaths of the population concerned for the very first time, really, about our environment and what we were doing to it. So the effect of this book was really kind of threefold, besides raising awareness. It was the effect the book had. Chemical companies, of course, hated it. Of course, she was basically pointing, you know, her eye at chemical companies and what they were doing to the environment. So they did not like that at all. But despite that, her activities still led to an actual change in the United States policy on pesticides, and really a great deal of just outright banning of a lot of it. But even perhaps even more impactful was the environmental movement that was inspired by all of this, and it started taking off and eventually could be linked directly to the creation of the United States Environmental Protection Agency. So to really show how important she was, President Jimmy Carter awarded her posthumously the Presidential Medal of Freedom. Amazing honor. So amazing life, amazing books. So remember Rachel Carson. Mention her to your friends, perhaps when discussing organophosphates, ectomopathogenic fungi, or neonicotinoids.
So Bob, the story of Silent Spring and DDT is really complicated, though.
Yeah, you're right.
It is controversial. I think that creating the EPA was a good thing. Drawing attention to the issue of pesticides is a good thing. But, you know, she, I thought, oversimplified the case against DDT, just like I think similarly there are pro-DDT people who oversimplified the case for it. It was effective, you know, in combating malaria, although it was being overused, you know, by current historical accounts, and was leading to a lot of resistance. You know, there's a lot of resistance developing to DDT. But at the same time, it wasn't, you know, the toxic effects weren't as bad as what, like, Carson was saying, and the anti-pesticide people were saying either. So there's a much more nuanced story in there somewhere.
Absolutely. You
know,
I agree.
We need to say that. You know, we can get into that in more detail on a separate segment. But I don't think that takes away from the good things that came out of her work, though. You know, but like,
yeah, I agree. That's why I think it was worthwhile still bringing her up, even though there's some of these other issues and controversies and complications.
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of controversies, I read an excellent article in the Genetic Literacy Project that I thought was such a great example. It exposed, you know, a great example of pseudoscience and how advocacy distorts the evidence. And it's a great lesson in how to separate fact from fiction, right? And we get this question quite a bit. How do we know what's true out there? We have people claiming different things, and how do you know which side is right? Like, for example, you have the anti-GMO side who cite studies, who make scientific claims, who have scientists who support their side. And then you have the pro-GMO side who cite studies and have scientists on their side, et cetera. How do we know which side has the better case? And it's not easy for complicated questions where there's a long history and there are dedicated groups generating tons of misinformation. I'm not going to tell you there's any simple formula, but there are some things that you can do. For example, you should always try to trace any references back to their primary source, right? So a primary source would be a published study or something that the an expert said, like not somebody quoting the expert or citing the study, but the actual source itself, the primary source. That way you're not relying upon the filtering, the cherry picking, or the interpretation of a secondary source that might have an agenda. Also, you should follow any controversy back and forth as far as you can go, you know, hopefully to the end, to see who has the final word, who has the most compelling case, and who just changes the subject and goes on to the next point without ever really addressing or acknowledging that they were handed a defeat in the exchange. You know what I mean? So it takes some work. Although usually when you do that, oftentimes, not always, sometimes you get, okay, this is a genuine controversy. You know, both sides kind of have legitimate points. And I love talking about those. Like, for example, for a while, there was a raging controversy. Are the Homo floresiensis bones, is that a new dwarf species of hominid, or is it a diseased Homo sapiens? And both sides had really good points and good evidence. And, you know, they were trading studies back and forth. I think that the side claiming that it's genuine, it's a new species, has the upper hand. But there was a long time where if you followed the arguments to their primary sources back to the beginning, it was a genuine scientific controversy. GMOs, not so much. You know, you have a dedicated ideological group, the anti-GMO crowd, who is building this a house of cards, in my opinion, out of false, misleading, cherry-picked information, bad arguments, internally inconsistent logic, and on close inspection, it collapses. It falls. And the pro-biotechnology side is really just the pro-science side, pretty much has the final word in any exchange on any individual point, in my opinion. But this is a great example of that. So there's a anti-GMO site called Independent Science News.
Okay.
I hate it when there's a generic name that disguises its true intentions.
Commandeering the term, right?
Yeah. Independent Science News. When in a June 3rd headline, here's the headline. GMO golden rice offers no nutritional benefits, says FDA. Right. So they're okay. Citing a paper by the FDA, and they're claiming that the FDA says that golden rice, this is now GR2E, that's the current cultivar. It's a genetically modified rice that has the precursor to vitamin A, beta carotene. That's what gives it its golden color. And they're saying that the FDA is saying that there's no nutritional benefit from this golden rice. The problem with that is that it's a complete lie.
Oh, nice.
It's deliberately misleading in order to create a false conclusion. In my book, that's a form of lying, right?
Yes.
In fact, it forced the FDA to write a response saying that their statements were misleading and explaining exactly how they were misleading. Huh. The article quotes the FDA saying that according to FDA rules, that they cannot claim that there are any nutritional or health benefits to golden rice. It does not qualify as a vitamin A supplement. And so you might think, okay, but that's pretty close to what they were saying, but not saying it has no nutritional value, just that it's not significant. But that's also highly misleading because it's leaving out a critical bit of context. So the FDA's rules combine how much of a vitamin is in any given substance, right? And how much of that food is typically consumed. So they multiply the amount of beta carotene in golden rice by the average daily consumption of Americans of rice. And it comes out to a small amount, 1% or whatever, of our RDA of vitamin A, which they say is not significant enough to call that a supplement of vitamin A. Or quote unquote fortified with vitamin A. But here's the issue, that's based upon a typical American consumption.
Which is vitamin rich to begin with.
Right. And we don't eat a lot of rice, right?
Oh, right. But as a ratio of the foods that we eat. Yeah,
we are not the target population for golden rice. The target population are third world countries where rice is a staple, where they eat rice every day as a significant portion of their calories. Mm-hmm. And if you multiply the amount of beta carotene in golden rice by their daily consumption of rice, it comes out to like 40 or 50% of their RDA of vitamin A,
well,
which is significant. It certainly isn't, quote unquote, no nutritional benefit. So they lied by omission, right? By omitting the context and by taking the FDA statement completely out of context, which is a very typical pseudoscientific play, right? I mean, that's right out of the creationist handbook. In terms, right, quoting scientists or agencies or whatever out of context. So that's just despicable, right? And and you know, it's also, I think, reasonable to conclude that this is not just a mistake on their part, right? And if you have to lie in order to defend your side, you probably have a weak position. If you had a solid position, you wouldn't have to distort the evidence in that way, you know what I mean? But reading their article, you wouldn't know that, right? You would think, oh, the FDA says it's not significant. So what's, you know, why are we supporting this? Golden rice is such a touchstone for anti-GMO pseudoscience because it breaks the anti-GMO narrative in just about every way.
I love when things like that break.
Right?
And it's not like they can point to another case or another product or another food, which helps them give validity to any points that they have on the anti-GMO side. They have to take something legitimate and parse it down, you know, whittle away little pieces of it, of what the FDA and other places are saying, and use that as their position. That is all that they have, which is absolutely, like you said, Steve, despicable.
Yeah, so and I think they're really flailing when it comes to golden rice because they are on the thinnest ice of all of their positions. You know, like with herbicide-resistant GMO varieties, you could say, well, this encourages the overuse of a specific herbicide, right? I mean, that's not a great argument, but I mean, it's a lot better than what they got for golden rice. For gold or with pesticide-producing like BT, you know, again, you could say it's going to breed resistance. Again, it's not a great argument, but it's not insane. But for golden rice, there's no issue with pesticides. There's no issue with patenting it because it's being offered for free as a humanitarian effort, right? So there's no corporation, there's no patent, you know, issue. We're going to control your food supply. It's not to increase profits. It's purely as a way of fortifying food because, you know, 800,000 children die of vitamin deficiency every year and 250 to 500,000 children go blind every year from vitamin A deficiency. And this is despite huge efforts at fortification and getting them other vitamin A rich foods. You know, it's making a dent, but it's not really solving the problem. This is just another way. Hey, let's fortify their staple crop with beta carotene. And that could have a huge, you know, impact on vitamin A deficiency. And the anti-GMO crowd is opposing it. I mean, it's at the point where you have to say, you want, you know, poor children in developing countries to go blind and die from vitamin A deficiency rather than allow a GMO crop to have a win. You're that anti-GMO that you're going to condemn, you know, hundreds of thousands, millions of children to death and blindness. That really is what it gets to. They are. That's what they're doing. And they have to twist themselves up into logical knots to keep that from being their reality. And this is one way that they do it. They go, well, it doesn't work. It doesn't work. It can't work. Well, why would you say it doesn't work? It has significant amounts of beta carotene in it. And so they distort what the FDA says to do that. Here's another thing that they do. So in the same article, they say that the amount of beta carotene in the golden rice decreases significantly over time when the rice is stored. And this is true. It's true, but it's also a massively misleading statement. And again, it's like you have to go to the primary source of the study that they're citing and read it in order to see what their error is. So first of all, beta carotene reacts with oxygen. So beta carotene decreases in all foods with vitamin A, not just golden rice. This is not a defect of golden rice. This is a universal feature of all foods with beta carotene because beta carotene is highly reactive with oxygen. So they cite a study where they looked at golden rice and the levels of beta carotene, looked at all the carotenoids, like all the, and all the breakdown products. It was a very thorough study, and they tracked them over 200 days. And what they find is that the levels of beta carotene specifically decreased significantly from about 30 nanograms per kilogram to 3.5 or so. So that's like a, whatever, an 80% decrease, you know, they or something, you know, over 120 days. And, but then it levels off, you know, then it pretty much levels off down at around the 3.5, you know, nanogram level, right?
Nanogram.
But here's the thing. When the FDA did its calculations and showed that it would provide 40 to 50% of the RDA for children in developing countries where rice is a staple, they were using the lower number. They were using the 3.5, not the 30. So yeah, if you start at 10 times the number and it decreases down to the number that everyone's using, you can say, look, there's this dramatic decrease of 90%, 80, 90%. It's like, yeah, but no one's using those numbers anyway. No one's using the amount of vitamin A in the first couple of weeks because the beta carotene reacts with oxygen. They're using the stable number that where you get to after it's been stored for 60 days or whatever. Again, you can look at the graph because, you know, it declines pretty rapidly, then it stabilizes. So they're using a fake number. It's a completely non-issue.
Yep. Just so they can
– unbelievable.
Just to try to bolster their indefensible position. It's it's really so, beyond the pale.
But why can't people see through this?
You can, but this is what you got to do. You got to go back and read this dense study as a primary source to see where they lied. But most people aren't going to do that. But here's the thing, the anti-GMO crowd, they have their talking points. The FDA says it has no nutrition, and it decreases. It's even worse because it's going to decrease over time. That's what they say. It's even worse than the FDA says because as you store the golden rice, the vitamin A levels are going to decrease over time. And both of those main pillars of that article are completely misleading. It does have significant amounts of vitamin A. And even when you use the lowest number, you know, not this artificially elevated number for freshly picked rice that no one's using anyway.
I wonder if Independent Science News feels they got a victory out of this because the FDA did respond to them, almost sort of legitimizing them beyond what they're worthy of.
Yeah, well, the story is getting spread around. They're not the only ones saying it. This is now a talking point in the anti-GMO crowd, right? This is now the talking point. And then even in the comments to my blog, you know, people, they're bringing up these talking points. I had to address, you know, like I was talking mainly about the FDA statement. And somebody goes, what about this whole issue about the vitamin A declining? You know, I had to go back and go to that original study. Say, no, that's total bullshit too.
Oh, boy.
You know, but that's it. But you get those talking points are out there. It is you know, literal fake news. But, you know, this is what we're combating. And it takes a lot of work to expose this. But, you know, or you could read somebody else doing it, but then you're just comparing two different sources. And which one are you going to believe unless you do the work yourself and see what the primary sources actually say? And it took me time. You know, I had to invest a couple of hours to really dig down to the information to find out what was going on. This is not simple.
But it's easy enough for them to throw, you know, do these drive-by kind of attacks by throwing out these absolutely false statements. And now and they expect other people to go and clean up the mess, essentially. Or not refute it at all.
Or not. Yeah, no, they just expect this is just talking points for their supporters. This is just feeding the anti-GMO narrative. You know, that's it. And, you know, whenever we publish these things on Facebook, it's amazing, you know, Facebook is just such a window, you know, into social media that the number of people parroting talking points that were handed to them by an ideological agenda is amazing. They just do it over and over again, talking point after talking point. They are just regurgitating propaganda. And they're doing it as if they're clever and insightful, and they know what's really going on, you know. And they're just being cynical, right? They're mistaking cynicism for skepticism, and they're just using these talking points that other people handed them with an agenda. And of course, we're the ones who are misguided, and we're the sheeple, right? Because they can regurgitate pre-digested talking points. It's so the irony is just so incredible.
Is this a form of the Gish Gallop?
Partly. And, you know, they just keep throwing a book, you know, because the Gish Gallop is great when your job is sowing fear and doubt, right? This mm-hmm. is the merchants of doubt approach. This is the science denial approach. You don't have to establish a position that holds water unto itself. All you have to do is just keep throwing a bunch of shit against the wall and enough to make people go, well, there's got to be something. Something's got to stick, right? There's got to be something right. wrong with GMOs. It just feels icky to me now. And then they're just creating, like they want to create a health halo around organic and whatever and natural. And they want to cast fear mongering over things that they don't like GMOs. So people just have this visceral instinctive reaction. Ooh, it's icky. GMOs are icky because I heard so many bad things about it. If half of them are true, it's bad, right? But of course, none of them are true. If you dig down to each one is utter BS. It all collapses. And then of course, you portray the people who are exposing you as shills, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm a shill.
Yep.
I'm a shill because I went back to the original study and showed that it was BS. And I also loved pointing out that they say the FDA is bought and paid for, right? And even in the Facebook, oh, it's bought and paid for FDA, right? It's just another talking point that they get handed. If that's true, why did the FDA write what they wrote, right? So they basically handed a propaganda point to the anti-GMO crowd because they had to follow their own guidelines and their own rules. I should also say that the only reason why they were saying anything about it was because the FDA approved golden rice in the United States, which is purely symbolic because it's never going to be grown or sold here. It's not for us. It's not for the United States. It was also approved in Australia and New Zealand. Again, it's never going to be grown or sold there. This is to lend support to, you know, we're using basically our infrastructure to do some of the heavy lifting to lend support to poor countries so right. that they could feel confident to approve it themselves. Because, mm-hmm. you know, these big and more wealthy countries used their resources to look at the scientific data and to go over it. But it's not for us. It's never going to be sold in the US. So again, what's the motivation here? What's the motivation to approve it? What's the motivation to make this, you know, wonky, narrow statement that is technically true according to the FDA's internal rules, even though it produces this misleading talking point for the other side. It doesn't fit their narrative in any way, which is why they're desperately flailing for any talking point they could find. And they leap on these things, which basically in the end makes them liars, which are opposing a technology that will save the sight and the lives of poor children in developing countries. The end result of what they're doing is literally evil, mm-hmm. even though they may mean well. But that's what blindly following an ideological narrative gets you to.
It's like a cult, essentially.
It is. It is.
Anti-GMO is a cult. Let's face it.
In that way, it is. It's an ideological narrative. Unfortunately, a very successful one.
Yep.
You know, we are really, it's an uphill battle for us to point out, you know, what a house of cards it is. And there are organizations like Greenpeace behind it, you know, well-funded NGOs like Greenpeace. And luckily, shame on them. Shame on them for doing it.
Absolutely. Luckily, it is as much of a slam dunk as it is. I mean, it really is. Amazing science, amazing progress. And the bottom line, if we want to feed the earth in 2050, we need GMO or it's not going to happen. Bottom line.
It's true. It's true. And when I'm trying to be positive, I think, okay, they can do this and it's definitely having a negative effect. It's holding it back. It's unfortunate. People are dying because of it, literally. But at the end of the day, it's going to get through. It's going to work. It's going to save lives. And, you know, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting. When all is said and done, the technology is going to speak for itself.
Rice pudding.
And it's going to bulldoze over these anti-GMO talking points. Once it is saving blind kids in Africa and Southeast Asia, what are they going to say? They'll go on to the next thing, but it's, you know, when the technology works, it works. We saved in the United States, we saved the chestnut tree from extinction, which was being wiped out by a fungus because now we have a GMO chestnut. right? We saved the papaya industry in Hawaii. And so the Hawaiians, who are very anti-GMO and passed laws banning GMOs, carve out an exception to the papaya. You know why? Because without it, they would have no papaya industry. Yeah. One of their huge industries would go bye-bye. So they have to grudgingly allow GMO papayas in Hawaii. And so that's what's going to happen is they'll continue to be exceptions. When there's the anti-GMO laws, like the Vermont law that was, you know, forcing labeling of GMOs, they made an exception for cheese. You know why? Mm-hmm. There is no cheese industry without GMO rennet. It doesn't exist. So they're nibbling around the edges, but they have to allow GMOs when they're truly useful. When they do things like save entire species, save entire industries, save people from blindness. And so we are going to have to just keep pushing forward, take those wins, and just fight against the wind that they're producing. And hopefully slowly turn around public opinion just by the successes, you know, of the technology.
Hope so.
Really frustrating. All right, Jay.
Steve.
I can't believe we're talking about this again. Solar roads. Come on. Why is this still a thing?
Solar roads again.
Yeah. I mean, look, just because other people failed doesn't mean that other companies and, you know, other researchers won't break through a lot of the barriers that were hit, right? But Steve's right. I mean, last couple of times we talked about solar roadways, it was more of a joke than anything. It was like we were laughing about it and how ridiculous the claims were, and there was a lot of, you know, woo mixed in with what they were saying.
Yeah.
But I found this and I thought it was compelling and a little hopeful. So listen to this. So in Jinan, China, researchers are doing a round of testing on their solar roadway. And this could mean that, you know, some of the barriers that we saw in the past are actually broken, and the solar roadway might be a possibility. So a company called Shandong Pave Energy, along with the help of Zhang Hongqiao, who is an engineering professor at Tongji University in Shanghai, they developed the latest version of the solar road surface. Now, the basic idea of the solar roadway is what? Like, there's lots of reasons why we'd want one, but I think a lot of it has to do with land conservation, right? Why would we want the road to collect energy? You know, why wouldn't we just put the solar panels in other places and all that? It's because, you know, there's a lot of paved road everywhere. When you think about all that highway space, it's quite a bit of land that's being used. Roads take up a significant amount of space, and it would be ideal to have them do something, not just be paved with pavement, but have them collect energy as well as give us a surface to drive on. Another benefit is that the collected energy could be used in the vicinity of the roadway. It's a big deal to push electricity long distances because you lose power. You actually, you know, energy is lost when you do that. So if you could have the energy used locally to where the energy is being produced, you would have little or no energy loss. Now, another cool thing is also imagine the road having heating strips that could enable it to melt ice and snow. I think that would be wonderful. You know, there's a lot of problems with ice and snow, especially in New England. The roadway could also have built-in lights to make the visibility even better. And it even could communicate information to drivers. And it might also be possible to recharge your vehicle on the road. This would be like, yeah. Now, Ev, check this out. Do you remember when we were kids and we had those electric car tracks? You put them together and you could smell like the ozone in the air and the car.
Yes.
Right? That's, you know, we're not talking about having these, you know, not that obvious. I'm sure they would do it through more of like that magnetic kind of radiation thing where it would recharge the batteries. But that's what it's kind of like, you know? Just need those controllers and we'd be good to go.
That's right. Yep. Metal contacts we used to use for the cars and the track, and off it went as long as the metal stayed in contact.
Yeah. I used to actually build ramps. Okay. Like I would make it jump, you know, because you could disconnect the track and it would still work. It's pretty cool. So there's a lot of reasons why companies want to spend money and time to crack this nut, because there's a lot of benefit here, and with a lot of benefit means a lot of profit. Speaking of profit, overall, the cost of solar panels has dropped significantly, right? Everybody knows that. Back in 1977, the cost per solar panel watt was $76, and today it's below a dollar. I'm seeing figures that vary, of course, but, you know, I saw figures down to 30 cents. So that's a huge change. Huge change. Now, these panels that they're using for the road are made of a complex polymer that looks like plastic, but it has a little more friction than a typical road surface. And the lead researcher said that the friction level could be adjusted per the requirement. You know, thinking about like maybe that they would make the road have a little more grit to it if it's around a dangerous corner or something like that. And I thought that was cool because it's not just – it's improving on road surface because road surface is a road surface for the most part. But imagine if they could make the road even have more grip action to it, you know, have more friction actually around dangerous turns or, you know, roads that people have to be very cautious on. And I thought that was an interesting little doodad that they can add in there. And with other previous iterations of solar roadways, two of the obvious concerns were durability and safety. In this latest iteration, the researchers are saying that the roads are both durable and safe to drive on at high speeds. And this was one of the reasons why they just did a test, was to see how safe the road would be in a pretty significant turn. I think that, you know, if they've tested it for safety, the real thing here is just the durability. Now, the researchers know that the roads are durable, but they don't know if they'd last 10 or 15 years. Now, a typical paved road needs to be repaved after, you know, in that time frame between 10 and 15 years. So trying to figure out the economics of this. So asphalt costs about $120 per square meter. Now, when we compare that to a solar roadway, that cost goes up to between $310 and $460 per square meter. So the researchers are saying that because these solar panels that they would be using would only be collecting about half of the energy of a roof-mounted solar panel, and that's because they're lying flat, they can't move. Another reason is because that cars are actually covering the sun from them, and also trees and things like that would be covering the sun. So they don't capture as much as the solar panels on Steve's roof, so they estimate they capture about 50%. The researchers are saying that they can say each square meter could produce about $15 a year worth of electricity. So over time, it would take 15 years with current technology for the technology to pay for itself. And then that would be right around the time when you'd have to repave. So I think that they know the price is going to come down, and they know that their technology is going to get better as time goes on, and that it will become economically feasible to do this. Now, there was one other thing that I read. I don't think we brought this up last time, but they were concerned that people were going to steal the roadway. I think that's a legitimate concern. Yeah, so they'd have to foolproof it somehow, or, you know, you can't have cameras everywhere. You know, what would you do? I don't know. It's a tough one to crack as well. Yeah,
people do steal copper and, you know, plumbing fixtures and
oh sure,
telephone wires and all sorts of stuff that they can't keep an eye on the entire time.
Yeah, so keep in mind, I mean, our criticism of solar roadways was never that it's impossible to do it.
Sure.
It's just that why would you invest the money to put the solar infrastructure on the roads when there's still plenty of empty rooftops? You know, that's where you should put the infrastructure.
Most bang for your buck, right?
Yeah, I agree, Steve. Yeah. I mean, I think in China, where they're spending a lot of money on this, space is at a premium. Like, there isn't free land.
Yeah.
And, you know, they want to...
Yeah, it's free rooftops.
Sure, of course. And look, China is doing such an amazing job with solar energy. I mean, they're the world leader. I think, you know, 3/4 of all solar panels are manufactured in China. They're coming out with some of the best and most innovative technology. And this is something that would solve a problem that they have, which is definitely, you know, lack of land. So maximizing their roads and their rooftops, I think, is smart.
Wait, China lack of land or Japan?
China, Bob.
What? Lack of land in China? What are you talking about? It's huge.
Yeah, but they have over a billion
people
there. Yeah. I mean, it's a very populated country. And, you know, one of the reasons why this company is investing the money and time is because of that. So, yeah, they have a problem with it.
It just seems that, you know, it may eventually be a workable technology, cost effective, et cetera. Once solar panels are so cheap and so efficient that, yeah, if the cost of the energy could be made back in 5 to 10 years, you know, more quickly than you have to replace the average panel, you know, the average segment of it. I think 15 years, they're being generous. We'd have to do a study where we say, first of all, how does the efficiency degrade over time? It probably doesn't stay at 50%. It may go down to 40, 30, 20, who knows?
Yep.
How long, what's their effective lifespan? what do you do with them when they're done? You know, what's the recycling?
Can you recycle them?
Yeah. or disposing of it. What's the resources? You know, if you have to use limited resources to make solar panels, why are you going to put them on roads that are going to have half the efficiency and half the lifespan when you could put them on a rooftop and have twice the efficiency and twice the lifespan for the same raw materials? So there's lots of ways in which this just isn't material and cost effective. And so I just don't think it's still not, a, we're not
ready
there.
For prime time.
Yeah. It's just not ready for prime time. And again, you know, because it's not an on-demand energy production, it would have to be combined with a massive increase in the grid, the grid's ability to take intermittent, you know, power generation. You know, we're running into that problem. We will be, you know, eventually, you know, you can run into it locally, but, you know, in terms of, we are running into it in some states that they're produced, like California produces more solar power than it needs at the time, you know?
Right.
Storage.
So it has to sell it across state lines. If we had enough grid storage, that would be a solution, but we don't have it right now.
Yeah.
And we've talked about the problem of grid storage too. There's no easy solution to that either. So just all the pieces of the puzzle aren't there yet. And it just seems that the solar roadways is not the way to go in the short term. And it's a waste of resources. You know, it may be something that we could think about in 20 or 30 years, you know, when the technology really is dirt cheap, you know, and where cheap, efficient panels are nothing, you know, then making use of all of the space, you know, of roadways might make sense. It just doesn't seem to be a worthwhile investment given where the state of the technology is right now. And the fact that there's just so much lower hanging fruit to pick first, you know?
Sure.
That's the key. That's the key. And even in 15, 20, 30 years, it still might be a silly idea. You could have areas of the United States where you just have concentrated solar production, you know, like many football fields worth or more, like square kilometers. And you wouldn't need too many of those to power a good chunk of the United States. I mean, you know, you could just focus on these specific – there's so many other ways and other low-hanging fruit, as you say, that it may never be a viable option, you know?
Right. But certainly not now.
Definitely not now.
It's like, you know, and I could see one company, you know, exploring the technology to see where it is, and then it gives us a baseline to follow in the future so we could say, okay, we could establish – where we do need to get to before we would invest in it significantly. So that's fine. I have no problem with that. As long as they're not diverting funds to invest in it prematurely in a massive way. That's always a problem. It's like, remember when California invested in the hydrogen economy, the hydrogen superhighway?
Early 2000s.
Yeah, 16, 17 years ago.
Yeah.
Way prematurely.
Prematurely.
Like, I understand they were trying to get ahead of the game, but that's the risk you take is that you go in the wrong direction.
You pick a horse, that horse may explode.
Yeah. okay, Evan, this is a frustrating news item as well. The comeback of polio.
Oh, can you believe it? And this is bad news and it's gone viral. Literally. Polio has been reported in Venezuela, according to a recently released report from the Pan American Health Organization. The last case of acute polio in Venezuela was, you want to guess the year? How long ago?
1990s, early 2000s.
Yeah, that's right, Steve. 1989. And the last reported case in the Americas, that's North America, South America, 1994. What was once gone has been forgotten, but now it's creeping back. Sound familiar? Yikes.
Why did that happen?
2 years and 10-month-old child with no history of vaccination, a resident of an under-immunized indigenous community in Delta Amacuro, Venezuela, with paralysis onset flavor of polio. Yep. Now, they're going to send these, and this was recent, this was the end of April 2018 in which this sample was taken. It's being sent to other laboratories for confirmation, but I think they're pretty secure that this is what it is. Real quick, polio is short for poliomyelitis. Poliomyelitis is a highly infectious viral disease which mainly affects young children. The virus is transmitted through contaminated food and water, and multiplies in the intestines. With three levels of severity, there is the Weakest one, the abortive, in which you have these minor illnesses like fever, headache, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, and systems only persist for a few days at a time, two to three days, and is often mistaken for other viruses. And the next one is the non-paralytic version. It has all the same features, but with some meningeal irritation and muscle spasms. And of course, the worst one is the paralytic. Now, 0.1% of all cases end up paralytic, but the incident rates are higher if you pick up that virus as an adult. And that gets you all the above, plus tremors, muscle weakness, intestinal obstructions. It wreaks havoc with your nervous system. And of course, permanent paralysis can occur. Many people infected do not even have the symptoms, but they do excrete the virus through their feces and in turn transmit the infection to others. Yuck. Polio can only be prevented by immunization. So when you have a country that is in a state of chaos, as it is Venezuela, in which so many things about their society is collapsing or has collapsed, and their healthcare system seems to very much be one of those aspects, you're going to start to have these kinds of incidents, unfortunately, in which eradicated, or what we thought were eradicated, viruses, or at least areas in which it's been eradicated for a long time, can make their way back. Let it be a warning call to us all, especially those in communities in which we choose not to vaccinate our children and adults.
Yeah, and we have to remind everyone that, you know, we're at on the brink of eradicating polio from the world. Mm-hmm. But vaccine refusal in, I think it was Nigeria, right? It was one of the African countries.
That is.
Allowed it to persist.
Yep.
They basically were lying, saying that, oh, the, you know, America is giving you AIDS through the polio vaccine. Don't take it. This was spread, you know, from the mosques. And that was enough to allow it to persist and then spread. And then it, you know, now it's in two or three countries. It's now jumped a continent to South America, to Venezuela. So, but we have to hope this is an isolated case and that polio is not becoming endemic in Venezuela again. That would be a massive step backward. So, it's just so sad, you know, that we were so close to eradicating something as horrible as polio. I mean, snatched defeat from the jaws of victory because of anti-vaccine fear mongering, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Really
Afghanistan and Pakistan, along with Nigeria, Steve. Those are the three countries in which it's considered endemic.
I hope, let's really, really hope Venezuela doesn't get added to the list.
Hope so. But, you know, this is newsworthy because we have not seen this in the Americas for literally decades.
24 years. Yep.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Evan. Bob, you have some good news for us.
Yes, please.
About supercomputers.
Yes, this of course got my attention and excitement, as it always does every half decade or so when something like this happens. So the fastest supercomputer in the known universe has now unofficially unseated China and is back in the United States after six long years with the Department of Energy and IBM's Summit supercomputer, which combines high-performance computing, as you would expect from something called supercomputer, and artificial intelligence applications, humming along at an amazing and unprecedented 200 petaflops or 200 quadrillion floating point calculations per second.
Oh, I love it.
200 quadrillion, twice as fast as the former first place. And this is all unofficial. The top 500 is gonna do, they do the benchmarks every, like, twice a year. And at the end of this month, they're gonna, you know, give us a top 10 or a top 500. Again, and it's, everyone's pretty much expecting that Summit will take the top position. So this is, you know, of course, I admit a little bit of national pride at this announcement, partly because, well, I haven't felt much national pride in, I don't know, how many months is it now? But also considering, besides that, considering the types of breakthroughs that a computer like this can make in terms of cybersecurity, encryption, you know, things that have to do with national security. It's just nice to have a democracy, any democracy or republic, host such a machine.
Yeah.
Cybersecurity, I mean, it's been in the news for quite some time now. It's huge. It's important. And the better your computer, the better chances you have of actually dealing with it and coming up with a way to prevent that from happening. So, like I said, Summit is a blazing fast 200 quadrillion or 200,000 trillion calculations per second. That's twice as fast as the former champ, China's Sunway Tyree Light. So the stats, of course, as you might imagine, are more impressive when you drill down. The sheer size is maybe not what you might not think in terms of a supercomputer. Two tennis courts worth, filled with 250 refrigerator-sized cabinets. That's a summit.
That's crazy. Right.
Yeah, but it's not this little console on the bridge of the Enterprise. This is a big boy. So, Jay, how much memory does your computer have?
I'm literally – it's funny you say that, Bob, because right now I'm just formatting a new 4-terabyte hard drive.
4-terabyte. Ha! That's crap. 4 terabytes. Even double it. 8 terabytes. We're talking 10 petabytes, 10,000 terabytes, or 10 million gigabytes. Imagine 10 petabytes of memory. Holy crap. So, and I'm just getting started here. The Summit cluster, the Summit cluster has 4,600 nodes, which doesn't really mean that much to many people. And it's not important. What's important is that these nodes contain over 9,000 IBM CPUs. And these are not your ordinary CPUs. These are the new Power 9 processors. Each one has 22 cores. Do the math. That's 200,000 cores in this supercomputer. I mean, what? That's incredible. But as awesome as that is, the real workhorse, at least according to some people, is not the CPUs, but the GPUs, the graphic processing units, which have been provided by NVIDIA, right? GPUs are great for gaming graphics, obviously, because they're amazing number crunchers, but they also provide massively accelerated computation for high-performance computing platforms for a while now. And they're also used extensively in AI applications. So Summit is using both. So it's no surprise that Summit has GPUs coming out of its ass ports. So we're talking about an astounding 27,000 GPUs in Summit. 27,000 GPUs. Man. Amazing, staggering amount. Paresh Garia is a product management and marketing director at NVIDIA. Claims that GPUs are responsible for 95% of the system's performance. So that's something. Just amazing. She says Summit is the most powerful and the smartest supercomputer in the world. An interesting claim. People always say it's the fastest, it's the biggest, but this one is quite literally the smartest supercomputer in the world. From many perspectives. Bob, so what will it do? What will it guys,
yes,
what do you
exactly.
got?
Yeah, what can this bastard do?
Yeah. Can it core an apple?
Oh, nice. Honeymooners, man. Nice, nice. There's lots of things that it can do. They're actually they're taking proposals. If you've got a good enough proposal that the Department of Energy I think is worthy, then it would seriously consider it. It's not like it's not slated for top secret things that nobody can talk about. This is going to do regular stuff. It's going to be doing molecular dynamics. Earthquake studies propagating through Earth's mantle, supernova simulations, very cool. Fusion research.
Here we go.
Not fission research, fusion research. And then when you bring
What's
into
your
the
point?
five years
fusion
away.
Baby.
Bob, solar road research.
No, that shit. So in terms of the AI applications, we're talking things like cancer research, genetic factors that contribute to addiction, lots of ways that AI can be able to assess these massive databases of information, bring it all together and come up with some conclusions that would take, your laptop PC, probably 30 years to come up with. And that's all fantastic. But of course, once the excitement dies down a little bit, I can't help but think that this is just a warm up because in a few years, the real talk is going to be the successor to the summit, the next really big number one on the top 500 supercomputer list. And this is going to be the first exascale class supercomputer. This is a quintillion operations per second, 10 to the 18 floating points. This is coming soon. This is like on the drawing boards. China says that they're going to have it in 2020. We might even, with an exascale supercomputer in a few years, be able to at least start reverse engineering the human brain on some levels. But even an exascale supercomputer won't be able to do that justice. That they predict will take something that is on a scale of a zeta scale supercomputer.
Oh my gosh, we're heading there.
That could be another decade or more before we see something at this scale. This would be three orders of magnitude faster than even a the exascale, which is a few years away. So we're talking 10 to the 21 floating point operations per second.
There we go.
One of my favorite numbers, a sextillion, an amazing number that you're going to be hearing a lot in probably a decade. So that, and then, oh, I mean, all bets are off with that. That's going to be just amazing. And I'll probably talk about what that computer can do in a few years when the exascale comes out.
Yeah, that is really incredible. But still, we are a couple of orders of magnitude away from simulating a human brain. Think about that.
Yeah.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
I knew you were going to say that.
I hope so.
Okay, guys, last week I played this noisy.
That is a DJ who does not know what he's doing.
That is funny, man. That does make me laugh. So, guys, what is this? Come on.
Well, it's broken, whatever. Anybody? It is.
Whatever it is, it's busted. Half of these things are busted.
And it might have actually hit somebody.
Yeah. The worst guest this week was sent in by a listener named Patrick Carr. And Patrick said, "Hi, Jay. I think today's noisy is the sound of a drill press operator realizing 2 seconds too late that his hand was in the way."
Oh, gosh.
Patrick, that is not correct, but very funny, as long as you're not the guy at the drill press. Another listener wrote in, "Absolutely love the show, longtime listener, first time guesser. In this week's noisy, a fidget spinner being spun up to some crazy RPMs and breaking from the intense centripetal force at the end."
Now he's getting close.
That's Dave Ledden from Perth, Western Australia, mate. And yeah, not a bad guess there, Dave. Not bad. Not correct, but not bad. We had a winner from last week, Jeremy Hatch. And Jeremy said, "The sound is the slow-mo guys using a vacuum cleaner motor to rotate a record until it flies apart." That is absolutely correct.
Wow.
This is a YouTube channel called The Slow-Mo Guys. A lot of people love it. And that's what they do. They slow things down. They wanted to see, and this is from Kirk.
Oh, those
this
guys.
Yes. This was written actually from Kirk Mona, the person who sent the noisy in. He said they wanted to see what it would look like to spin a vinyl record so fast it would shatter. And they bolted a 12-inch record to a fan motor. They increased the speed until the disc shattered. The sound it makes comes up to speed is wild. So they spun the record past 10,000 RPMs until it ripped itself apart. And I will play it once more just so you can hear it now that you know. So I do recommend that you look at this because there's something very cool about what happens to the record and the beautiful pattern of cracks that it makes. The second that it cracks, they have it on the high-speed camera and they freeze frame it. And you could see like this wonderful pattern that the cracking record makes. I just happen to like art and chaos like that. So take a look if you're interested. And thank you all for sending me in those guesses. Lots of people sent in guesses. A lot of people got it right. But of course, somebody won like very soon after the show. Okay, so for this week's new noisy, this one is near and dear to me. And this was sent in by Brian Bohmuller. Bohmuller. Brian Bohmuller. Whatever. Here you go, Brian. This is a cool one.
Gosh.
God, I know, huh, guys? So just so everybody knows, everybody's reaction to that sound on the show had to be cut out because they couldn't keep their mouths shut, particularly Evan. And you could hear what they said in our premium content coming up behind the scenes banter. Pre-show banter is probably where I'll put it. Anyway, yes, this was a fun one. If you think you know what this week's noisy is, or if you heard something really cool this week, you can email me at WTN@theskepticsguy.org.
Thank you, Jay. All right, guys, let's do a quick Name That Logical Fallacy. This one comes from Kian from County Cork, Ireland, and he specifically says not UK. So noted, not in the UK.
not that UK version of Ireland.
And Kian writes, "I'm a loyal listener since 2007. I have no doubt that you guys can answer the question I have. Here's the situation. Recently, in my local area of Cork, Ireland, a proposed waste-to-energy incinerator was given the go-ahead for construction. As you can imagine, there has been a huge backlash from the community. It seems in this case, the garbage won't do. And I've heard many arguments that are not the most science-based. One particular line of reasoning is this, that we should be promoting recycling and reuse, therefore reducing our waste, and that building incinerators goes against this sentiment. There is clearly a false dichotomy here, but it feels like there may be other types of fallacious reasoning when saying that building incinerators takes away from other methods of dealing with waste. If so, can you guys point them out to me? On a related note, the evidence seems to show that there are safe levels of toxic emissions from modern incinerators. The main argument from the anti-incinerator group states the contrary, but that is an interesting discussion for another time. Love the show. Never stop. Well, we'll have to stop sometime.
I mean, you know.
When we're all dead, but until then, we'll see what we can do.
Pry our skepticism from our cold, dead hands.
Right.
I'm holding my skepticism right now.
Okay, right.
I call my skepticism Charlene.
And you will be faithful. Or faithless, is it?
Well, I mean, on the surface here, he says that the building incinerators takes away from other methods of dealing with waste. I mean, sure, there's an opportunity cost. If you spend money on one way of dealing with waste, then that money cannot be used for another method of dealing with waste that could be more efficient. For all I know, so on that level, it makes sense. I mean, there is an opportunity cost when you commit money to something like that.
But is this a fallacious argument when you say that you should be promoting recycling and reuse, therefore recycling our waste, and building incinerators goes against the sentiment? Is that fallacious?
Yeah, it depends. So it could be a false choice, right, which is a type of false dichotomy. It's like, well, it's either A or B. So if you're choosing A, then you're neglecting B. Well, you could do A and B, right? Build incinerators for non-recyclable garbage and recycle the stuff that's economically viable to recycle. And that's probably what's happening anyway, right? But Bob would be correct if just that were factually true. If there really were a decision like, all right, we have this much money as a town. Are we going to invest in a recycling plant? Or are we going to invest in an incinerator? And maybe it's not a false choice. Maybe it's an actual choice because of limited financial opportunity or whatever. We'd have to know the details. It sounds like, from what Kian is saying, that there's not like a literal choice. They just don't like the idea of incinerators because it takes away from the idea of recycling. And that is clearly a false choice because there's nothing inherently mutually exclusive about those two, especially since there's different types of garbage. And, you could put stuff in the recycling and then incinerate the stuff that doesn't go in the recycling stream, right? We have two streams of garbage. Doesn't everybody, you guys all have two streams,
at
right?
At least
we have
two.
Recycling. We have single stream recycling and then everything else.
Yeah, we don't cross the streams either.
Well, composting,
you never cross the streams.
I
do compost now, if you guys remember. So that's a third stream. I compost some stuff, and then most of my garbage goes in the main garbage stream, and then I recycle what can be recycled. So so you incinerate the stuff that can't be recycled or composted. You compost what could be the biodegradable stuff, and you recycle the recyclable stuff. What's the big deal? So the only thing you really have to ask is incinerating waste cost and environmentally effective way of disposing of that waste? And that's a complicated question, but the benefits are you could actually burn it for energy, and then you don't have to dispose of all that waste. You don't have to just plow that waste underground, right? So there's a land use issue as well. The downside would be, what's being released into the atmosphere. And that's why, Kian mentions the toxic emissions. That's really the only, I think, deal killer that there could potentially be with burning it. And it seems like it isn't, So, I do think that the false choice is the main logical fallacy there. And the devil's in the details, right? It's all really going to come down to, as we were discussing with solar roadways and with a lot of those technologies, you have to think about the effectiveness at many levels, not just cost effectiveness, but energy effectiveness and environmental effectiveness. If it makes sense, and also versus the other options, it has to make sense when compared to, well, what else are you going to do with the garbage, right? If you're just going to plow it underground somewhere, is there a land use issue? Is there, are the toxins going to just leach into the environment slowly or in the water table or whatever? So it really depends. But again, if you really want to know the answer, you've got to drill down on the details as it is being specifically implemented or suggested, you know, in your specific case or area, right? And in order to do that, you got to have access to the details. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real, one fake, and I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yes. Ready.
Let's do it.
All right. I think you will find these very interesting. Item number one, scientists have demonstrated a commercially viable method for extracting uranium from seawater, which has 500 times the uranium as land-based ore. Item number two, a new study reports a technique for using magnetic particles to improve the taste of wine. Item number three, a new analysis finds that subjects remember information no better when presented in virtual reality versus traditional desktop displays. Evan, go first.
Oh, a commercially viable method for extracting uranium from seawater. 500 times the uranium as land-based ore. Yikes. Okay, so what I'm learning from this is that the method itself is not in question. This apparently does happen because they've apparently improved on it, made it commercially viable. So the technology certainly exists. I had no idea you could extract uranium from seawater. So learning things every minute here. But 500 times the uranium as land-based ore, that's a lot. But the ocean is big. And the ocean is the, you know, great recipient of all that washes off the land. So maybe over so much time, it would add up to a quantity that results in a 500x factor here. So I have a feeling that one's science. The second one, the study reporting a technique for using magnetic particles to improve the taste of wine. Well, here we're dealing with some subjective things, right? I mean, improving the taste of wine. And then using magnetic particles to improve them. Boy, I'm always leery of the benefits of magnets in these kinds of unconventional ways, shall we say. I don't know about that one. The last one, where the subjects remember information no better when presented in virtual reality versus traditional desktop displays, no better. I don't know about this one. It's the one I have kind of the least feeling about. I think perhaps that one is the fiction. They were probably surprised when they found out that it's the opposite, that the virtual reality is, in fact, better than the traditional desktop displays. And yes, why not? I'll throw my coin down as a plus for virtual reality. I will say that one is the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
Let's see. This first one here, extracting uranium from seawater. There's two things here. Commercial viability of doing that is that's fantastic. I'm not 500 times the uranium as land-based ore. It's hard to evaluate that. I mean, the Earth is 75% water, so sure. I know it's funny that you had picked this because just very recently I was reading that there is 20 million tons of gold in the oceans. That's 771, nice. Over seven, almost $800 trillion worth of gold in the oceans. Yeah, it's out there. But it's tiny and it's dispersed. So if they have a method to actually collect it in the water efficiently, commercially viability, that's fantastic. And I'd love to hear how they could do that. But that one's that's a little tricky. I'm not sure. Oh, it depends. So let's look at the second one here. I want that. I kind of want that to be true, to have magnetism in some way affect our senses or taste in that way. I just want that to be true. That's really fascinating. The third one, let's see. Test subjects remember information no better VR or traditional desktop displays. I don't know, man. When I looking at your VR, Steve, it's just such an amazing thing. So maybe, you know, you could become inured to that to a certain extent, but I would think that that would be just an amazing way to teach. And I know they've used VR in the past to help people get over phobias, and that because that's the realism, of course, is just through the roof. It's not much better than any type of display because this is, you know, 3D wraparound, whatever. So it's, you know, you're transported to the environment. So it's so effective. I think that could translate into a better learning experience. So yeah, I'll say that one's probably fiction than VR.
And Jay,
the first one, I have no reason to think that is the fiction, extracting uranium from seawater, which is 500 times the uranium as land-based ore. I mean, I could see why it would have more, but 500 times seems like a lot more, but I just can't really pick this apart in any way. So let me just move on to the other two, which I do have some comments about. So this one about the using magnetic particles in wine. On the surface, it seems like silly, you know, like, you know, waving that stupid credit card in front of a glass of wine. But the magnetic particles might be attracted to certain particles in the wine. And I think this is only part of the story. I think that there might be more to this. I suspect that the magnetic particles would have something to do to make the wine taste better by maybe removing stuff from the wine. But they'd have to filter it again. Yeah, because I think they're attracted to particles in the wine, and then they could pull those things out. So this analysis finds the subjects remember information no better when presented in virtual reality. I don't agree with this because I don't think it's no better. I think it is better in virtual reality. I think that when you're in virtual reality, you're more immersed in the, you know, environment, and you're taking in more information, and it's more visceral. There's definitely more to learning in VR than there is in a 2D or, you know, standalone desktop.
Okay, so you guys all agree with each other, huh? So we'll take these in order. Scientists have demonstrated a commercially viable method for extracting uranium from seawater, which has 500 times the uranium as land-based ore. You guys all think this one is science, and this one is science. Yeah, I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, how do you do that?
One of the criticisms of using uranium-based fission reactors is that that uranium is a limited resource and that, you know, we're going to run out of it. Lo and behold, there's 500 times as much in the oceans. It's just sitting there. All we have to do is figure out a way of extracting it. And that's what these guys did. So, you know what they use?
Magnets?
Yarn.
What?
Yarn.
All right. Never would have thought of that. Yeah.
Even waste yarn, like very basic, cheap yarn. So very, very inexpensive.
Wow. Not even the good yarn. Wow.
Polymer fiber.
Those cheap bastards.
Yeah. So, you know, they treated it in such a way that it has a specific affinity for uranium, and it's also reversible. So they could basically just let the stuff, you know, sit in the salt water. It will soak up the uranium over time. They were able to make yellow cake. Yellow cake is what you make from uranium. Ooh. That you use to power.
Don't mess with that.
Reactors. Yeah. Now, well, they only gathered a small amount of it, but they only had a small amount of water. You know, it was just a test. I think they were able to collect 5 grams of it. So not a lot, but if you did this at scale, you know, if you had a huge uranium mining operation in the Gulf of Mexico, for example, this could produce a significant amount of uranium at around the same price as mining it on land, so it's commercially viable. The seawater contains about 3 parts per billion of uranium. Not a lot, but there's a lot of water out there.
Oh, yeah.
There's at least 4 billion tons of uranium in seawater, which is 500 times the amount of known uranium land-based deposits. 500 times. Pretty amazing. He also says that, these fibers can be used to extract other heavy metals like vanadium. Have you guys ever heard of vanadium?
No. Nope.
That is a metal, very, very expensive metal used to make large-scale batteries. So that would be nice. And maybe they could adopt it, Bob, to mine that gold from the ocean as well. Imagine if you have one fiber that it soaks up uranium, gold, and vanadium. You know, and then the gold basically pays for the whole thing, and then you get these other things, you know, at the same time. But they're very useful minerals. There's a lot of minerals in seawater.
Oh man, 20 million tons of gold. Oh my
God. All right, let's go to number two. A new study reports a technique for using magnetic particles to improve the taste of wine. You guys all think this one is science using magnets to treat wine.
Yes.
And this one is Science.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is definitely the one that sounded the most like pseudoscience.
Yes, it did.
Definitely.
Because there are a lot of magical wine improving, you know, hoaxes out there, including magnets. You know, you put this magnet next to the wine and it's supposed to make it taste better. But this is using actual science. This is a study published in the ACS Journal of Agricultural and Food Chemistry. So they're using tiny magnetic particles. Jay, you're correct. They're using it to remove something.
Yeah, I read this, so that's why I knew it.
Ah.
Okay.
They're using it to remove substances called alkyl methoxypyrazines. It produces a vegetable-like aroma in certain varietal wines, but it could also make it taste bitter, and it can overwhelm the fruity or floral bouquet that connoisseurs appreciate about the wine, apparently. And so if you remove it, the wine will taste more fruity and fruitful. And so it can subjectively can improve it.
Well, that's great.
I try to look and see if there's any other. All of this means that a new analysis finds that subjects remember information no better when presented in virtual reality versus traditional desktop displays is the fiction. I could not goad you guys into voting against virtual reality, because the study shows the exact opposite, that when the same information was presented in virtual reality versus desktop, the people in VR remembered it better. And they were, however, using memory palaces to remember information.
Cool. Right?
So a memory palace is when you imagine the bits of information you're trying to remember in a three-dimensional space. So it makes sense, right? If you're trying to remember the information three-dimensionally, that having that information presented to you in virtual reality would be more of a mnemonic, you know, than just 3D presented on a two-dimensional screen. Yeah, not surprising. And it does show, I think, the potential of VR for education and communication. I do think that, you know, we've talked about VR before. You get this visceral experience that you just don't get with 2D information. And we're really just at the beginning of VR. We're picking the low-hanging fruit, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we're going to learn a lot. Because the bottom line is it successfully tricks the brain. It works. It's above the waterline where the brain is treating the information as if you are physically in that three-dimensional space. And so that engages the brain in a way that two-dimensional information simply does not. And I think we're going to, over the next 10, 20, 30 years, we're going to learn a lot of things about how to exploit that fact. You know, we're going to be seeing a lot more, I think, from VR. I'm still loving my VR. However, I haven't been able to play for 2 months.
Yeah, well, you're right. You're back in your office now, Steve, and I will be over there on Friday to hang with you.
Just today, I'm back in my office. I got my furniture.
All right.
That's what I was doing this afternoon, mostly unpacking. So tonight is the first time I will be sleeping in my bed alone with my wife in 3 months. My wife and I and our two daughters have been sharing one bedroom.
Whoa.
So that
think
means,
about that for a minute.
Okay.
Yeah, Jesus, think about that. Just to give you the update on my home repairs.
Yeah.
The kitchen, the downstairs should be ready in a couple of weeks, but the kitchen cabinets won't be installed until July 16th. So I still got a full month, and then it'll take 2 months to get the 2 weeks to get the countertops in place. So another 6 weeks before it's 100% done. This is turning into a 6 month ordeal.
Yeah, that's just...
I tell you, just a little bit of water.
Never would have guessed it would be that long.
Yeah, well, and, you know, to be fair, we're upgrading a lot of things, you know, while we're...
That's true.
We're ripping out the ceiling, the floors, you know, while you're doing that, like, it's a golden opportunity to
electrical,
do things that you'd have to rip out
stuff.
So we're like, I'm upgrading my wiring. We're getting new lights put in. We took down a wall. We're getting, you know, new kitchen cabinets. So we're doing a lot of stuff. We were overdue for a lot of upgrades. This is a golden opportunity just to do everything right now. But 5-6 months without a working house has been rough.
That is rough.
It is rough.
Yikes. And producing a podcast every week without fail. Thank you.
My wife and I were sharing an office for a couple of months now, but finally we got our own offices back at least.
Oh, God. How good, Steve. Doesn't it feel great when you slid back into that chair and you're like, oh, man.
Yeah.
I really do need my own space in the house, you know, like it's just a room I need to have.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Well, I think I was more in her way than she was in my way, you know, because she had to vacate her office when I was doing the show, you know, I was doing any recording. But slowly, but now we're at the point where we're getting stuff back rather than having it being taken away. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Right. Right.
Starting to move back into our house. So it's.
Yep. The reassembly. Good. Yeah. It's a good stage.
All right, Evan, give me a quote.
Being a woman scientist in my country is very challenging. Some people see me as a threat and do not understand why I'm not in the kitchen. When I'm out in the field collecting data, some people look at me strangely and wonder why a woman is in a forest with a team of men. But I love what I do, and all these challenges encourage me to learn and to do more as a woman scientist. And her name is Adwoba Kuamanza Edya. She's a research scientist at Ghana Atomic Energy Commission and a doctoral candidate in hydrogeology at the University of Ghana in Ligon. So, wow. good for her.
This is a recent quote?
Yes.
Yeah, yes, there was just a report that came out in Science about sexual harassment in STEM fields.
Mm-hmm.
And it's significant, you know, the rate at which women feel held back in their careers because of sexism is much greater.
Oh, gosh.
You know, like 30-40%. Yeah, so it's still a huge problem in STEM. Yeah.
Yep. We got a long way to go. Getting a little better, but still more effort.
Yeah, we've got to keep the pressure on. Definitely. Absolutely.
Definitely.
All right. Jay, Nexus is coming up, and I hear there's a bit of news.
A little bit of news.
We are extending the early bird deadline for 1 week. So you have until Friday, June 22nd to get the third off your admission tickets for Nexus,
yes,
which is in New York City at the Fashion Institute of Technology, July 12th through 15th. We, of course, will all be there doing all sorts of stuff, live show, workshops, panels, lectures. It's all going to be good
stuff.
And our feature speaker this week is Michael Marshall. Marsh, you guys know Marsh.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
He is the project director of the Good Thinking Society, a journalist and a fellow podcaster and, of course, skeptic. Michael Marshall is one of our UK colleagues. They're getting it done, doing a good job in the UK. He also helped to found QEDCon, which mm-hmm. we will be at QED this year, guys.
Yep, October.
October. Can't wait.
Right after our book comes out.
That's going to be a really fun trip. Yep. I've never been to England.
It's beautiful. I'm going. It's awesome.
So he will be speaking for us on Friday during the Science-Based Medicine Day.
Nice.
His talk will be Fighting Pseudoscience in the Heart of the UK Establishment.
Oh, boy.
All right, guys. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thank you, Steve.
You got it, brother.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.